This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. This season of True Tales of Luxury is proudly sponsored by Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.
Dream big and never lose sight of that end goal. And I think we have this belief together that, you know, nothing is impossible. We have no doubt in our minds that, you know, what we're trying to create is one of the biggest luxury houses ever.
In this series of podcasts from Harrods, I'm talking to people at the top of the creative industries about their work and its relationship to luxury. Today, I have not one, but two guests, Tamara Ralph and Michael Russo. Between them, they've created what might be Britain's most successful haute couture brand in the last 100 years. That's how long it's been since the last British designer was invited to show their collection on the official schedule at Paris Haute Couture Week, alongside the likes of Chanel, Dior, and Valentino. With more than 1,000 clients across the world, Ralph and Russo represent haute couture at its most luxurious. And now, with their ready-to-wear brand, with its amazing shoes, bags, and clothes, it looks like they're set to be as successful on that score as well. I wondered if we could start, first of all, with the beginning of your story together, because it sounds too ridiculously romantic to allow you to get away with not describing it for me. Can you tell me how you first met and Tamara, how you ended up being in the UK?
Well, I actually took a last-minute trip for the summer just a couple of weeks before, decided to take a trip to Europe and had my first stop off in London. And then I arrived in London. This was, I can't remember what year it was, 2004 perhaps,
so, yeah.
Was when we, yes, 2004. And I was walking down the street in Fulham, a little bit lost, trying to find my girlfriend's house because I'd never been in London before. And we were walking toward each other down the street and we both weren't looking and then happened to run into each other. And for some reason, we started talking. I don't know why. I think we both realized we were both Australian and there was almost like an instant connection, really, that we felt like we'd known each other forever. And we stood there talking for like an hour and a half, something like this, in the street. Like we
went to a complete stranger that you'd literally walked into.
Yes. No, it was really like we were long lost friends that we just, you know, hadn't seen each other for a long time. It was really bizarre. And then I remember I went to my girlfriend's house. I said to her, "You wouldn't believe I just met this guy in the street." And she was like, "You just arrived."
She goes, "What?" "I've been looking for years."
I know. And then I remember, and I still remind her to this day. She told me at the time, "There's no way that you can like be friends with this person." Like, because she was like, "You don't just meet someone in the street."
Yeah. She'd been in the country for 4 hours.
Yeah. And
you thought easy pickings, did you?
I've been standing on the street for the last 6 hours.
No. And anyway, so we became friends. I was living in Australia at the time. We talked all the time on the phone.
And then, Michael, you sent her a one-way ticket.
I did.
To London. That's like the most romantic thing I've ever heard.
I did. I had enough after about, you know, 12 months of this, and I sent her a one-way ticket. So Tamara scrambled around and literally drove from one city to another overnight to get a fast-tracked visa. I think you drove all through the night, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
I warned our listeners that this was romantic. This is like you're really upping the ante now. Now, so there was instantly attraction at first sight, love at first sight even possibly, but business at first sight? Or
no,
when
that
did that evolve?
That came a little bit later, actually. You know, after I came to London, we talked about it, but it was something that we wanted to plan properly, really kind of set our foundations. And actually, we were so excited about it. We registered the brand name quite a while before we actually started trading. Because I think the brand name was registered 2007, but we started trading 2010.
Yeah.
I was still back and forth from Australia, so I wasn't actually based here all the time.
It actually took us 3 years to agree on the name and who came first. Ralph or Russo. Eventually she won with her name first. And then, 3 years later, we started the business.
In which case, it's a miracle that you've managed to build the business to such incredible levels so quickly. Three years to decide on the name.
I came so much quicker.
I'm thinking that perhaps the kind of whole decision-making process became a lot more speedy after that.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. I won. My name came first. We had a family vote, actually. We put it towards both families and they all voted for for Ralph first.
They did.
Even yours.
Yes, they did.
So you were an investment banker.
By trade, yes.
And you had already started designing, but were you designing as a business at that point? Or
yeah, I mean, I have quite a few generations of fashion and design and craftsmanship in my family, both in couture, ready-to-wear, shoes. And so it was kind of something that just came naturally. And when I was 8 years old, my mum told me that I sketched my first dress, and I used to just sketch all the time. I started kind of really spending a lot of time with my grandmother and my mother, who had a small atelier in the house that would make pieces for private clients. And my grandmother actually ran the haute couture atelier for several designers, both in England when she was younger and then in Australia, and was in the industry for quite some time. So she was very strict and would teach me draping and embroidery and stitching and things like this. This was really her kind of territory.
And you did it out of love at that time.
Out of passion, yeah. Mm. And it was honestly, I would come home and from school and just go straight into the atelier and spend all my time in there.
What was fascinating you?
I don't know. I just love the creativity side of things. She had this big library of all the vintage Vogue patterns that you used to have back in the day from like the 70s and the 80s. And she had a big collection. And I would go wait till she went out because I wasn't allowed to touch much in there. And I would wait till she went out and I would cut them up in to create something more modern. And even to the point where I would actually go into her wardrobe and pull pieces out and customize them because I thought she would like them better that way. And
were you ever found out?
Yeah, of course, because she would come home and her leather coat was now short and things like that. She laughs at it now, but at the time she was not very happy. I didn't even think twice about it at the time, but looking back at it, I thought, oh my God, I was an awful child. But no, and it was really something that I just loved. And
so you were already working as a designer then when you came to London. You were already working as a designer in Australia.
Yes.
And did you have private clients then, or were you working as a designer for a
Both. I was consulting, but I also had a lot of private clients, and I had private clients even before I went to study after high school, actually. So
when you were what age you had private clients?
You know, I had my first client at 15. So, yeah, well, actually, I was making pieces from the age of 12, and I had a few friends that were like, oh, I love this, can you make me one? And as a sassy child, I would say, well, you have to buy it. So it was very cheeky. But anyway, I kind of, outside of family and friends, my first big private client was at around about 15, 16, I think. And then it was at that point that my mom said, I think this is not a hobby anymore. You should register a company name because you're making money, you know, from this.
So you had your own company when you were in your late teens?
Yeah, it was very small. It was, you know,
it's a company.
But it's still, yeah. And it was, I would spend all weekend buying fabrics and making things, and then I would sell them as well throughout the week. And it was quite a good income for teenager, actually.
And what was your signature? What was the style that people were buying into when you were a teenager? What was your sort of fashion dream?
Well, I mean, the thing is, looking back at it, it actually had quite a big couture aspect to it. Obviously, I couldn't afford to have the most beautiful fabrics and rolls of them. So what I actually did was the most exclusive fabric supplier in Sydney, I became friends with the owner because I was just there all the time. So I would go there after school and just hang out and look at or dream, and like it would be like my museum, you know, and I would see all of the beautiful silks that were all imported from Italy and things like that. And I think she kind of felt sorry for me from hanging around a little bit too much. So she would donate things
scraps
to me.
So you had been designing private things for yeah, private clients for quite some time by the time, but you were still young. You were in
I actually did quite a few high profile weddings at like I think when I was just even in the last year of college for some quite prominent Sydney women. So it happened quite young, quite fast, but it was something that I was worked at all the time. Like my mum said, she would come down at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I would be asleep at the sewing machine when I should be in bed or studying. or something.
So we've established that you were quite obsessive for a young woman. Yeah. And then did you feel when you came to London that you were giving that all up, or did you have an idea that this was going to be a sort of step further along the path to designing greatness?
No, I mean, when obviously we met, we'd spoken about before I moved to London, you know, perhaps the idea of setting a brand up together and toying with the idea, because I'd grown my client base to quite a few high profile women in Sydney at the time. I didn't know what the next step really would be, but I knew that what I wanted to do and what was in my heart and what my grandmother, obviously skill-wise, had taught me from a craftsmanship point of view was couture, to start with that. And there wasn't the scope of industry and clientele currently in Australia. It's different now.
But also, I mean, in this country, there was a dying tradition, not a new tradition of haute couture at all. And you're a money man. You kind of have a business brain. What on earth possessed you to think that a really great thing to do with your career would be to start a new haute couture house?
Tamara was so passionate about it, and she was so talented. And I think, you know, I was looking for a new business to do something in, and there was a gap there in the market. It was something that, as you say, was dying. You know, I think, you know, we had these aspirations, we had this joint vision that we wanted this global luxury brand.
I think what's great about when we, I mean, still to this day, but when we set up the brand, Michael came from a very different perspective than what's considered the norm in fashion and, you know, the steps you need to follow to be a fashion brand. And so he kind of threw everything on its head. And I always said, oh no, we have to do a collection, and then we have to do this, and then we have to do that. And he would always question and be like, why? Why do you have to do that? That's going to take investment, and then you have to sell the collection, and then you have to manufacture the collection. And
so what gave you the courage, or have you always had that rebellious spirit? And what were the things that you felt you could naturally rebel against?
He'd like to rebel against everything.
I would. I don't think it was that. I think it was just like, you know, it sort of made common sense at the time, you know. And as Tamara said, you know, we weren't, you know, able to invest a lot of money or anything. So we really had to take it back to the basics. And what the investment was actually Tamara's time and her painting of this sketch and the design and everything. We would take the sketch to the customer. The customer would pay for it. We'd use that money. We'd make the dress. And then we do the next one.
So really, you pared it right down.
But looking back at it, it was actually, you know, the market had changed so much, and we were kind of modernizing the process a little bit without even thinking about it. But we were more doing it because it was really the natural path for the company to take.
But how do you imagine a business model like that? Because basically, when you're setting up a haute couture house, you're relying on a very small number of people to be so committed to you that they're prepared to spend the sort of GDP of a small nation on a year's wardrobe. Yes?
Absolutely.
So when you write that business plan, I mean, I'm imagining being the bank manager who's funding it, and you go, yeah, well, I need approximately 50 women who are going to spend this a year. And it's like, what? In 2007? I mean, that was a year before the financial crash. So where were these initial clients coming from? I mean, how do you find clients for couture?
It happened, like Michael said, very organically. You know, I actually was wearing one of my pieces out in the evening one night, and I had some lady come up to me, and she said, oh, I love your gown. Where did you get it? And then I said to her that I designed it myself, and then she took my number, and then she called me and she said, can you come over? I'd like to buy some pieces. And so I did, and then that client just grew from there. And even a lot of our kind of big celebrity clientele right from the start were also via word of mouth. You know, it wasn't something that we had a PR or marketing team or anything dealing with. It was literally like one private client who happened to know Angelina Jolie or Beyonce or something, and then, you know, also got referred to them. So,
and before you had the beautiful fitting rooms and the beautiful salons for people to come to, did you just seem very amenable and were always prepared to go to people's hotel rooms and their apartments, or did you have a sort of hotel suite you'd rent to kind of?
No, we traveled and saw the clients a lot, you know, and actually it was what they wanted. Luxury is about time these days a lot. People don't have enough time. So the easier we can make it and enhance their life, then it's...
That's the other thing that's different about your ethos, isn't it? I mean, first of all, you started at the top.
Yeah.
Rather than at the bottom making just, you know, a few little garments, you know, to sell in a boutique. So you started with couture, but you also reinvented actually the experience of couture, as I understand it, because, you know, it used to be a bit like going to the hairdressers in the 1950s, where, you know, if you were lucky, you had the whole day there, you know, and everything took forever.
Yeah.
And you worked out that that was absolutely the antithesis of what modern women, even ladies of leisure, that we're after.
Yeah, there's still a lot of traveling that, you know, the team and myself do these days. But I think there's a lot to consider in, like, the modern couture. I think it's changed a lot. You know, women want that extra luxury. There's a big clientele globally and a lot of new markets that can now buy couture as well. And I think that people want things immediately. It's kind of the nature of everyone at the moment. You know, I think social media, everything, everyone, even with ready-to-wear, people want it instantaneously as soon as they see it on a catwalk. It's important as a brand to be flexible and realize what's happening in the market and be adaptable, because couture is definitely not a dead industry. For us, it was the other. It was completely the opposite. It was just people needed something else these days.
But I think there's also an element of education as well, because, you know, people hear the word haute couture, they see it in a magazine, but until you see it in person, it's a different experience. And I think, you know, what we've tried to incorporate through our retail network now is really letting customers, making couture a little bit more accessible. Because what we found is actually when the customer can come and see it and touch it and feel it without having to book an appointment and wait for months to get a time to view it. Actually, if you can make it a bit more accessible, what you're attracting is a huge different sort of scope of market of, you know, emerging markets or even from just countries. What we're finding is that we're actually getting a lot more ladies into couture.
Obviously, a lot of people listening to this will be thinking accessible, 50,000 for a day dress, 150,000 baseline for a dress for a special occasion. They're not really accessible prices. So who would be the clients for your clothes? Which are these emerging markets that most appeal?
You know, because we've had quite a few people that have had the couture experience that we offer in some of the select retail destinations. And they weren't couture buyers in the past because it was always a little bit of a daunting process to, okay, I've got to book an appointment and I don't know the price points and I've got to go to Paris and then I've got to do this. And it was just something that it was just maybe it's a bit too fussy. But then when they can actually see a product there, realize how beautiful it is and not feel intimidated to inquire and ask about the price and do it quite leisurely, then they actually like the fact that they can get something like that exclusive and have something beautiful, one of a kind, without everything else attached to it. So we have, you know, a very young clientele coming through, which is really interesting. They're kind of, you know, customizing couture in a young way. Just as an example, some of the gowns this season for a particular client who wanted to kind of pair them more with t-shirts and sneakers and things like that. So we kind of customized them into couture skirts and things like that. So it's really interesting to see how it's all moving.
I know that you can't really talk about, obviously, you know, naming your clients and things, but I'm sure for a lot of people listening, there's a sort of fascination about who these people are that can sustain a company selling clothes at the prices that you do, you know, with the incredible work that goes into them and everything, you know, straight during and after, you know, a financial crash that left the world sort of shocked and stunned. You know, who are these people? You know,
we're very private about our clientele, which is probably what they love. But I think, you know, it's really a mix.
It is a mix.
You know, it's really a mix.
A mix of what? Well, of oligarchs and Chinese billionaires and Middle Eastern princes and, well, princesses, I suppose, or sheikhs or, you know.
Everyone, because it's like, it's really from businesswomen to...
It's so broad.
The youngest client we have made for is 3 months old.
That can't be healthy for a baby, can it? it?
Well, it was for a big event and it was a very beautiful gown. And the oldest client is in her 80s, late 80s. So it's such a broad mix, you know, and it's...
The thing that struck me when I was just reading about you both there was that there is something deeply unlikely about two Australians. You know, because when we think of Australia, we think of sort of the beach, yes, and surfing and kind of don't care about anything and have a tinny and a bar. Yeah. And I know that's a terrible stereotype.
Yes.
But I mean, you'll be as well aware of it as I am.
It's a true stereotype, actually.
So how are you regarded by Australians? Are you a bit of an anomaly?
I think so. For a long time, the British press were like, British brand, the British. And then all of a sudden, you know, then there was a, like almost like a press fight. No, Australian designers. So it's like, it was interesting. But no, I mean, obviously they're very proud, you know, because I think when we were elected to show on the Paris Couture schedule, I think we were the first British brand in 100 years to be invited.
And you'd only been going, might I say, for was it 6 or 7 years at that point?
No less. we've just completed our 10th show, so that's 5 years ago. So it was our first ever fashion show. And previous to that, we'd never done a collection before.
A full runway collection.
The couture schedule in Paris is governed by the Chambre des Syndicats, which is the governing body of the French schedule, both on the haute couture, but then they also have the prêt-à-porter.
So incredibly powerful body in fashion.
Yes. And
prestigious.
Very prestigious. It's a very small schedule. I'm sure you're aware there's like not many brands that are invited to show. You know, we were the only British house and still are.
So it was an enormous compliment and a phenomenal thing to happen when you'd just been in business for 5 years, something
like that. Yeah, well, I think we were the first Australian designers ever, but the first British brand in 100 years.
In terms of like, okay, I want one of your dresses. What am I buying into? What's the thing? How would you describe your vision?
Well, I think they've got, you know, very much an elegant femininity to the pieces. I think they're kind of bold but very chic at the same time.
Quite structural.
Yeah, there's a lot of beautiful structural elements, draping elements, texture, detail, the embroidery work. So I think the tailoring is also something that clients really love from us, the kind of classic elegant but modern cuts. I think a lot of the feedback we also get from clients is there's a youthfulness within the designs. You know, it's classic but modern at the same time. It's like a...
And an incredible amount of work. I mean, I think there's a one wedding dress that took 50 embroiderers, some 6,000 hours.
Quite a regular thing.
Really?
Yeah.
And where do you find the embroiderers? Are there still young people coming up into those professions?
It's a bit of a mix. And, you know, actually, we set up an apprentice program in the atelier last year because we found that there was kind of almost like a comeback for young people wanting to learn the craftsmanship on the different areas. So we set that up, which has actually been very popular. And we also found when we first set up the brand, it was very hard to attract craftsmen because there was little industry left in London compared to what it used to be. And obviously all the couture houses were in Paris. So it was very difficult to attract. But obviously, since the brand's grown so much, now it's very easy to attract. But there was a time where the majority of the craftsmen were older. And we really said to each other that we need to make sure that we are nurturing and bringing in young people to pass the skills down to, because there's a lot of designers that I meet these days that don't actually know how to construct a piece. And I don't understand how you can sketch a piece that you don't know how it's put together.
So if I come and buy an haute couture dress rather than one of your ready-to-wear pieces, what am I getting for those of us who've never done that? what will be different about it? I mean, you know, I can, if I'm lucky, because I'm not a standard size, go into, you know, a variety of designers, and if I look hard enough, find something that fits really beautifully, and yeah. that's great. Yeah. So what can you add to that experience for me?
Well, I think for couture, it's a very personal and it's very individual. So, I mean, it's for us, I think, you know, you never forget how something makes you feel. And I always remember, like, growing up, when you make a piece and you put it on, you never feel as amazing as the first time you wear it, you know, and when it's been made for you and everything fits like a glove, you feel more confident, you look amazing, and that you can tell a tailored piece. So I think a combination of all of that is really something that is why people almost, it becomes like an addictive thing.
And now you've come full circle in a way, and you're now embarked on a ready-to-wear empire, which is growing almost as fast or faster than the couture business did. So how do you marry the two? Because if I used to come to you for couture, and now I can buy pieces by you in a boutique in Harrods or in Paris or in Beverly Hills or wherever, how do you keep that balance between the two, because you're coming from the other way around?
Yeah, I think it's complementary. We're able to really fit into the lifestyle, the complete lifestyle of the customer. So yes, they might want couture for a particular event, but now they want our ready to wear to go to university.
You're going to get a lot of flack at university if you're wearing, you know, a £50,000 dress. Though,
yeah. Aren't you? Yeah, that's the ready to wear.
If you have the Ralph Russo sneaker, you're going to look really cool.
You're both steeped in luxury. I'm sure that you get out of bed in the morning and you put on couture every day. Yeah. Why wouldn't you? You know. So when it comes to luxury for yourselves, what do you consider luxurious? What is a luxury for Ralph and Russo?
Well, I thought I would know what your answer is, but it seemed maybe something different. So why don't you start?
You know, my answer is actually a pillow. Really?
There's so much lack of sleep these days.
There's so much lack of sleep these days. Growing this brand, that my biggest luxury at the moment is sleep.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the investment in beautiful fabrics and materials on your bed is probably the best luxury combined with actual sleep. It's great to have the sheets and the pillows, but if you're not getting the time to sleep, it's a bit of a waste. But I think for me at the moment, the biggest luxury I get is sleep. It's the luxury that I want to have more of.
Yes.
And the perfect pillow would be... Do you want goose down? Do you want duck down? Do you want a mixture of the two? Do you want feather
and down? Throw as many on there as possible and just mix them up. And
do you want a linen pillowcase, or do you want, you know, 1,200 thread cotton? What do you want?
All of the above. I mean,
what's funny is he can't actually sleep unless he's surrounded by like four big...
I'm not joking about the pillows.
The point that you can't even see him anymore. So it's like, so when you say pillar, I'm not surprised that it's your biggest luxury.
Well, yeah. I think that's a very interesting luxury. And I do share your penchant for being surrounded by them. You need something to put your knee on.
Yes.
Your elbow.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and also to just build a little wall from the person snoring next to you. Yeah. That's just my problem. And how about you?
I actually brought mine along today.
Oh, thank you. Should we get it out?
Yeah, sure.
Is it a wooden box? It's a beautiful looking box.
It's a wooden box. It was actually a gift from one of my Japanese clients.
So it's bamboo, maybe?
Yeah.
And it's a bamboo box, very pale. I'm getting excited already.
It's a table runner.
Oh,
it's a little bit vintage now, but it's a table runner, and it's actually made from a royal kimono that was 300 years old that she then made into a table runner to give me as a gift.
Yeah. It's so beautiful.
It's very beautiful.
So describe it for me, and what is it about it that just makes you love it to pieces?
Well, I love the detail of the fabrics and the weave of the silver metallic and things.
Is it silver or cream?
Well, it's cream. Cream with a vintage silver. And I just love the story behind it. It's very nice.
Do you use it?
Of course we do. Unused things like this, what's the point?
So do you manage to squeeze in dinner parties as well as work? And actually, you know what?
He's upstairs sleeping.
He's upstairs surrounded by pillows. And your advice to any aspiring designer, maybe find an investment banker to love?
I don't know about that. I'm kidding. I think you just stay true to yourself and be passionate about it. It's a tough industry, but it's also a fun industry.
And an aspiring investment banker, find a designer to love?
Look out for good talent. I think, you know, not to give up, because I think in the fashion world, it is hard, as Tamara said. And I think dream big and never lose sight of that end goal. And I think we have this belief together that, you know, nothing is impossible. We have no doubt in our minds that, you know, what we're trying to create is one of the biggest luxury houses ever.
Really? Just that?
That's what we're doing.
And just finally, if I let you run loose in Harrods, which direction would you head? Which department?
Food court.
I'd go to the suites.
Really? Oh, the...
Oh, come on, Sweet Alley. Who wouldn't want to go there? Alley.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I get lost in there. I want to buy everything in the food halls.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. You're so welcome. Much.
Thank you.
Thanks. You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guests, Tamara Ralph and Michael Rousseau. Next week, I'm joined by the jewellery designer Anoushka Dukas, who tells me about starting a new brand with no formal training, and how her unquenchable thirst for travel continues to inspire her. This series is recorded in Harrods in London. Thank you to our sponsor, Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.